or crystals, first appear near the center of the cell and then migrate toward the surface. As a crystal reaches a cell wall, it disintegrates into hundreds of individual virus particles, and the broodlings push through the cell wall like hair and float away in the bloodstream of the host. The hatched Ebola particles cling to cells everywhere in the body and get inside them and continue to multiply. It keeps on multiplying until areas of tissue all through the body are filled with crystalloids, which hatch, and more Ebola particles drift into the bloodstream, and the amplification continues inexorably until a droplet of the host's blood can contain 100 million individual virus particles. After death, the cadaver suddenly deteriorates. The internal organs, having been dead or partially dead for days, have already begun to dissolve, and a sort of shock-related meltdown occurs. The corpse's connective tissue, skin, and organs, already peppered with dead spots, heated by fever and damaged by shock, begin to liquefy, and the fluids that leak from the cadaver are saturated with Ebola virus particles. When it was all over, the floor, chair, and walls in Sister M.E.'s hospital room were stained with blood. Someone who saw the room told me that after they took her body away for burial, wrapped in many sheets, no one at the hospital could bear to go into the room to clean it up. The nurses and doctors didn't want to touch the blood on the walls and were frankly fearful of breathing the air in the room, too. So the room was closed and locked, and remained that way for days. The appearance of the nun's hospital room after her death may have raised in some minds one or two questions about the nature of the Supreme Being, or, for persons not inclined to theology, the blood on the walls may have served as a reminder of the nature of nature. No one knew what had killed the nun, but clearly it was a replicating agent, and the signs and symptoms of the disease were not easy to consider with a calm mind. What also did not lead to calm thoughts were rumors coming out of the jungle to the effect that the agent was wiping out whole villages upriver on the Congo. These rumors were not true. The virus was hitting families selectively, but no one understood this because the flow of news coming from upriver was being choked off. Doctors at the hospital in Kinshasa examined the nun's case and began to suspect that she might have died of Marburg, or a Marburg-like agent. Then Sister E.R., the nun who had traveled with Sister M.E. during the drive to Bumba and the plane flight to Kinshasa, broke with l'épidémie. They put her in a private room at the hospital, where she began to die with the same signs and symptoms that had preceded Sister M.E.'s death. There was a young nurse at the Ungaliema Hospital named Mayinga N. Her first name was Mayinga, and her last name is given as N. Nurse Mayinga had been caring for Sister M.E. when the nun had died in the blood-stained room. She may have been splattered with the nun's blood or with black vomit. At any rate, Nurse Mayinga developed a headache and fatigue. She knew she was becoming sick, but she didn't want to admit to herself what it was. She came from a poor but ambitious family, and she had received a scholarship to go to college in Europe. What worried her was the possibility that if she became ill, she would not be allowed to travel abroad. When the headache came upon her, she left her job at the hospital and disappeared. She dropped out of sight for 2 days. During that time, she went into the city, hoping to get her travel permits arranged before she became visibly sick. On the first day of her disappearance, the date was October 12, 1976, she spent a day waiting in lines at the offices of the Zairean Foreign Ministry, trying to get her papers straight. The next day, October 13th, she felt worse, but instead of reporting to work, again she went into the city. This time, she took a taxi to the largest hospital in Kinshasa, the Mamayemo Hospital. By now, as her headache became blinding and her stomach pain increased, She must have been terribly frightened. Why didn't she go to the Ungaliema hospital to seek treatment where she worked and where the doctors would have taken care of her? It must have been a case of psychological denial. She didn't want to admit, even to herself, that she had been infected. Perhaps she had a touch of malaria, she hoped. So she went to Mama Yemo Hospital, the hospital of last resort for the city's poor, and spent hours waiting in a casualty ward, jammed with ragged people and children. I can see her in my mind's eye. Nurse Mayinga, the source of the virus in the United States Army's freezers. She was a pleasant, quiet, beautiful young African woman, about 20 years old, in the prime of her life, with a future and dreams, hoping somehow that what was happening to her couldn't be happening. They say that her parents loved her dearly, that she was the apple of their eye. Now she's sitting in the casualty ward at Mama Yemo among the cases of malaria, among the large-bellied children in rags, and no one is paying any attention to her because all she has is a headache and red eyes. Perhaps the fact that she's crying has made her eyes red. A doctor gives her a shot for malaria and tells her that she should be in quarantine for her illness. But there's no room in the quarantine ward at Mama Yemo Hospital. So she leaves the hospital and hails another taxi. She tells the driver to take her to another hospital, to University Hospital, where perhaps the doctors can treat her. But when she arrives at University Hospital, the doctors can't seem to find anything wrong with her, except for possibly some signs of malaria. Her headache's getting worse. She's sitting in the waiting room of this hospital, and as I try to imagine her there, I am almost certain she's crying. Finally, she does the only thing left for her to do. She returns to Ungaliema Hospital and asks to be admitted as a patient. They put her in a private room, and there she falls into lethargy, and her face freezes into a mask. News of the virus and what it did to people had been trickling out of the forest. And now a rumor that a sick nurse had wandered around Kinshasa for 2 days, having face-to-face contact with many people in crowded rooms and public places, caused a panic in the city. The news spread first along the mission grapevine and through government employees and among the diplomats at cocktail parties, and finally the rumors began to reach Europe. When the story reached the offices of the World Health Organization in Geneva, the place went into a full-scale alert. People who were there at the time said that you could feel fear in the hallways, and the director looked like a visibly shaken man. Nurse Mayinga seemed to be a vector for an explosive chain of lethal transmission in a crowded, third-world city with a population of 2 million people. Officials at the WHO began to fear that Nurse Mayinga would become the vector for a worldwide plague. European governments contemplated blocking flights from Kinshasa. The fact that one infected person had wandered around the city for 2 days, when she should have been isolated in a hospital room, began to look like a species-threatening event. President Mobutu Sese Seko, the maximum leader of Zaire, sent his army into action. He stationed soldiers around Ungaliema Hospital with orders to let no one enter or leave except doctors. Much of the medical staff was now under quarantine inside the hospital, but the soldiers made sure that the quarantine was enforced. President Mobutu also ordered army units to seal off Bumba Zone with roadblocks and to shoot anyone trying to come out. Bumba's main link with the outside world was the Congo River. Captains of riverboats had heard about the virus by this time, and they refused to stop their boats anywhere along the length of the river in Bumba, even though people beseeched them from the banks. Then all radio contact with Bumba was lost. No one knew what was happening upriver, who was dying, what the virus was doing. Bumba had dropped off the face of the earth into the silent heart of darkness. As the first nun at Ungaliema Hospital, Sister M.E., lay dying, her doctors had decided to give her a so-called agonal biopsy. This is a rapid sampling of tissue, done close to the moment of death instead of a full autopsy. She was a member of a religious order that prohibited autopsies, but the doctors very much wanted to know what was replicating inside her. As the terminal shock and convulsions came over her, they inserted a needle into her upper abdomen and sucked out a quantity of liver. Her liver had begun to liquefy, and the needle was large. A fair amount of the nun's liver traveled up the needle and filled a biopsy syringe. Possibly it was during this agonal biopsy that her blood squirted on the walls. The doctors also took some samples of blood from her arm and put it in glass tubes. The nun's blood was precious beyond measure, since it contained the unknown hot agent. The blood was flown to a national laboratory in Belgium and to the English National Laboratory, the microbiological research establishment at Porton Down in Wiltshire. Scientists at both labs began racing to identify the agent. Meanwhile, at the Centers for Disease Control in Atlanta, Georgia, the CDC, scientists were feeling left out and were still scrambling to get their hands on a little bit of the nun's blood, making telephone calls to Africa and Europe, pleading for samples. There is a branch of the CDC that deals with unknown emerging viruses. It's called the Special Pathogens Branch. In 1976, at the time of the Zaire outbreak, the branch was being run by a doctor named Carl M. Johnson, a virus hunter whose home terrain had been the rainforests of Central and South America. He's not related to Gene Johnson, the civilian virus hunter, or to Lieutenant Colonel Tony Johnson, the pathologist. Carl Johnson and his CDC colleagues had heard almost nothing about the occurrences upriver in Zaire. All they knew was that people in Zaire were dying of a fever that had generalized symptoms. No details had come in from the bush or from the hospital where the nun had just died. Yet it sounded like a bad one. Johnson telephoned a friend of his at the English lab in Porton Down and reportedly said to him, "If you've got any little dregs to spare of that nun's blood, we'd like to have a look at it." The Englishman agreed to send it to him, and what he received was literally dregs. The nun's blood arrived at the CDC in glass tubes in a box lined with dry ice. The tubes had cracked and broken during shipment, and raw, rotten blood had run around inside the box. A CDC virologist named Patricia Webb, who was then married to Johnson, opened the box. She found that the package was sticky with blood. The blood looked like tar. It was black and gooey, like Turkish coffee. She put on rubber gloves. But other than that, she didn't take any special precautions in handling the blood. Using some cotton balls, she managed to dab up some of the black stuff, and then, by squeezing the cotton between her fingertips, she collected a few droplets of it, just enough to begin testing it for viruses. Patricia Webb put some of the black blood droplets into flasks of monkey cells, and pretty soon the cells got sick and began to die. They burst. The unknown agent could infect monkey cells and pop them. Another CDC doctor who worked on the unknown virus was Frederick A. Murphy, a virologist who had helped to identify Marburg virus. He was and is one of the world's leading electron microscope photographers of viruses. His photographs of viruses have been exhibited in art museums. Murphy wanted to take a close look at those dying cells to see if he could photograph a virus in them. On October 13th, the same day Nurse Mayinga was sitting in the waiting rooms of hospitals in Kinshasa, he placed a droplet of fluid from the cells on a small screen and let it dry, and he put it in his electron microscope to see what he could see. He couldn't believe his eyes. The sample was jammed with virus particles. The dried fluid was shot through with something that looked like string. His breath stopped in his throat. He thought, Marburg. He believed he was looking at Marburg virus. Murphy stood up abruptly, feeling strange. That lab where he had prepared these samples. That lab was hot. That lab was as hot as hell. He went out of the microscope room, closing the door behind him, and hurried down a hallway to the laboratory where he had worked with the material. He got a bottle of Clorox bleach and scrubbed the room from top to bottom, washing countertops and sinks, everything, with bleach. He really scoured the place. After he had finished, he found Patricia Webb and told her what he had seen in his microscope. She telephoned her husband and said to him, "Carl, you'd better come quick to the lab. Fred has looked at a specimen, and he's got worms." Staring at the worms, they tried to classify the shapes. They saw snakes, pigtails, branchy forked things that looked like the letter Y, and they noticed squiggles like a small G, and bends like the letter U, and loopy sixes. They also noticed a classic shape, which they began calling the shepherd's crook. Other Ebola experts have taken to calling this loop the eye bolt, after a bolt of the same name that can be found in a hardware store. It could also be described as a Cheerio with a long tail. The next day, Patricia Webb ran some tests on the virus and found that it did not react to any of the tests for Marburg or any other known virus. Therefore, it was an unknown agent, a new virus. She and her colleagues had isolated the strain and shown that it was something new. They had earned the right to name the organism. Carl Johnson named it Ebola. Carl Johnson has since left the CDC, and he now spends a great deal of his time fly fishing for trout in Montana. He does consulting work on various matters, including the design of pressurized hot zones. I learned that he could be reached at a fax number in Big Sky, Montana, so I sent him a fax. In it, I said that I was fascinated by Ebola virus. My fax was received, but there was no reply. So I waited a day and then sent him another fax. It fell away into silence. The man must have been too busy fishing to bother to answer. After I had given up hope, my fax machine suddenly emitted this reply. "Mr. Preston, unless you include the feeling generated by gazing into the eyes of a waving confrontational cobra, fascination is not what I feel about Ebola. How about shit scared?" 2 days after he and his colleagues isolated Ebola virus for the first time, Carl Johnson headed for Africa in the company of two other CDC doctors, along with 17 boxes of gear, to try to organize an effort to stop the virus in Zaire and Sudan. The outbreak in Sudan was still going on. They flew first to Geneva to make contact with the World Health Organization, where they found that the WHO knew very little about the outbreaks. So the CDC doctors organized their equipment and packed more boxes, getting ready to go to the Geneva airport, from where they would fly to Africa. But then, at the last possible moment, one of CDC doctors panicked. It said he was the doctor assigned to go to Sudan, and it said he was afraid to proceed any farther. It wasn't an unusual situation. As Carl Johnson explained to me, "I've seen young physicians run from these hemorrhagic viruses, literally. They're unable to work in the middle of an outbreak. They refuse to get off the plane." Johnson, one of the discoverers of Ebola virus, preferred to talk about these events while fly fishing. "We've got to keep our priorities straight," he explained to me. So I flew to Montana and spent a couple of days with him fishing for brown trout on the Bighorn River. It was October. The weather had turned clear and warm, and the cottonwood trees along the banks were yellow and rattled in a south wind. Standing waist-deep in a mutable slick of the river, wearing sunglasses, with a cigarette hanging from the corner of his mouth and a fly rod in his hand, Johnson ripped his line off the water and laid a cast upstream. He was a lean, bearded man with a soft voice that one had to listen for in the wind. He's a great figure in the history of virus hunting, having discovered and named some of the most dangerous life forms on the planet. "I'm so glad nature is not benign," he remarked. He studied the water, took a step downstream, and placed another cast. "But on a day like today, we can pretend nature is benign. All monsters and beasts have their benign moments." "What happened in Zaire?" I asked. "When we got to Kinshasa, the place was an absolute madhouse," he said. "There was no news coming out of Bumba, no radio contact. We knew it was bad in there, and we knew we were dealing with something new. We didn't know if the virus could be spread by droplets in the air, somewhat like influenza. If Ebola had spread easily through the air, the world would be a very different place today."
"How so?"
"There would be a lot fewer of us. It would have been exceedingly difficult to contain that virus if it had had any major respiratory component. I did figure that if Ebola was the Andromeda strain, incredibly lethal and spread by droplet infection, there wasn't going to be any safe place in the world anyway. It was better to be working at the epicenter than to get the infection at the London Opera." "Are you worried about a species-threatening event?" He stared at me. "What the hell do you mean by that?"
"I mean a virus that wipes us out."
"Well, I think it could happen. Certainly it hasn't happened yet. I'm not worried. More likely, it would be a virus that reduces us by 90%. 9 out of 10 humans killed, and you're not bothered?" A look of mysterious amusement crossed his face. "A virus can be useful to a species by thinning it out," he said. A scream cut the air. It sounded non-human. He took his eyes off the water and looked around. "Hear that pheasant? That's what I like about the Bighorn River," he said. "Do you find viruses beautiful?"
"Oh, yeah," he said softly.
"Isn't it true that if you stare into the eyes of a cobra, the fear has another side to it? The fear is lessened as you begin to see the essence of the beauty. Looking at Ebola under an electron microscope is like looking at a gorgeously wrought ice castle. The thing is so cold, so totally pure." Carl Johnson became the chief of an international World Health Organization team that gathered in Kinshasa. The other CDC doctor, Joel Breeman, who had flown with Johnson to Zaire, became a member of a field exploration team that boarded an aircraft bound for the interior to see what was going on in Bumba. The airplane was a C-130 Buffalo troop transport, an American-made military aircraft that belonged to the Zairean Air Force. It happened to be President Mobutu's private plane, equipped with leopard-skin seats, folding beds, and a wet bar, a sort of flying presidential palace that ordinarily took the president and his family on vacations to Switzerland. But now it carried the WHO team into the hot zone, following the Congo River north by east. They sat on the leopard-skin seats and stared out the windows at endless tracts of rainforest and brown river, a featureless blanket broken by the occasional gleam of an oxbow lake or a cluster of round huts strung like beads on a barely visible road or footpath. As he leaned against the window and watched the terrain unfold into the heart of Africa, Breeman became terrified of coming to Earth. It was safe in the air, high above the immeasurable forest, but down there, it began to dawn on him that he was going to Bumba to die. He'd recently been assigned to Michigan as a state epidemiologist, and suddenly he'd been called to Africa. He'd left his wife back home in Michigan with their 2 children, and he began to suspect that he would never see them again. He'd brought an overnight bag with a toothbrush, and he'd managed to pack a few paper surgical masks and some gowns and rubber gloves into the bag. He didn't have proper equipment for handling a hot agent. The buffalo descended, and the town of Bumba appeared, a rotting tropical port spread out along the Congo River. The buffalo landed at an airstrip outside the town. The plane's Zairean crew was terrified, afraid to breathe the air, and they left the propellers idling while they shoved the doctors down the gangway and heaved their bags out after them. The doctors found themselves standing in the backwash of the buffalo as it accelerated to take off. In the town, they met with the governor of Bumba Zone. He was a local politician, quite distraught. He'd found himself in deep waters, in over his head. "We're in a bad way," he told the doctors. "We have not been able to get salt or sugar." His voice trembled on the edge of weeping as he added, "We haven't even been able to get beer." A Belgian doctor on the team knew how to handle this situation. With a dramatic flourish, he placed a black airline pilot's bag on the table. Then he turned the bag upside down, and wads of currency slapped out, making an impressive heap. "Governor, perhaps this will make things a little better," he said. "What are you doing?" Breman said to the Belgian. The Belgian shrugged. "Look, this is the way things are done here." The governor scooped up the money and pledged his full cooperation, together with all the extensive resources of government at his disposal. And he loaned them 2 Land Rovers. They pushed north toward the Ebola River. It was the rainy season, and the road was a string of mud holes cut by running streams. Engines howling, wheels spinning, they proceeded through the forest at the pace of a walk, in continual rain and oppressive heat. Occasionally they came to villages, and at each village they encountered a roadblock of fallen trees. Having had centuries of experience with the smallpox virus, the village elders had instituted their own methods for controlling the virus according to their received wisdom, which was to cut their villages off from the world to protect their people from a raging plague. It was reverse quarantine, an ancient practice in Africa where a village bars itself from strangers during a time of disease and drives away outsiders who appear. "Who are you? What are you doing?" they shouted to the Land Rovers from behind a barrier of trees. "We are doctors. We are coming to help." Eventually, the people would clear away the trees, and the team would proceed deeper into the forest. In a long and desperate day of travel, they penetrated 50 miles away from the Congo River, and finally, toward evening, they came to a row of round, thatched African houses. Beyond the houses stood a white church in the middle of the forest. Around the church, there were 2 soccer fields, and in the middle of one field they noticed a heap of burned mattresses. 200 yards farther on, they came to the Yambuku Mission Hospital, a complex of low, whitewashed buildings made of concrete with corrugated tin roofs. The place was as silent as a tomb and appeared to be deserted. The beds were iron or wooden frames without mattresses. The blood-soaked mattresses had been burned in the soccer field, and the floors were clean, spotless, rinsed. The team discovered 3 surviving nuns and 1 priest, along with a few devoted African nurses. They'd cleaned up the mess after the virus had wiped out everyone else, and now they were busy fogging the rooms with insecticide, in the hope that it might somehow disperse the virus. One room in the hospital had not been cleaned up. No one, not even the nuns, had had the courage to enter the obstetric ward. When Joel Breman and the team went in, they found basins of foul water standing among discarded, blood-stained syringes. The room had been abandoned in the middle of childbirths, where dying mothers had aborted fetuses infected with Ebola. The team had discovered the red chamber of the virus queen at the end of the earth, where the life form had amplified through mothers and their unborn children. The rains continued all day and night. Around the hospital and the church stood the beautiful, ferocious trees, a complex of camphors and teaks. their crowns entwined and crisscrossed and whispered with rain, and bowed and shifted as troops of monkeys passed through them like currents of wind, leaping from crown to crown, crying their untranslatable cries. The next day, the doctors set out deeper into the forest in their Land Rovers, and they made contact with infected villages where they found people dying in huts. Some of the victims had been put into isolation huts on the edge of the village, an old African technique for dealing with smallpox. Some of the huts where people had died had been burned down. Already the virus seemed to be petering out, and most of the people who were going to die were already dead, the virus having echoed so swiftly through Bumba. A wave of emotion rolled over Joel Breeman as he realized, with the clarity of a doctor who suddenly sees into the heart of things, that the victims had received the infection from the hospital. The virus had taken root with the nuns and had done its work among those who had sought help from them. In one village, he examined a man dying of Ebola. The man sat in a chair, holding his stomach and leaning forward with pain, and blood streamed around his teeth. They tried to reach Kinshasa by radio to tell Carl Johnson and the others that the epidemic had already peaked. A week later, they were still trying to make radio contact, but they couldn't get through. They traveled back to the town of Bumba and waited by the river. One day, an airplane droned overhead. It circled the town once and touched down, and they ran for it. At the Ngaliema Hospital in Kinshasa, Nurse Mayinga had been put into a private room, which was accessible through a kind of entry room, a gray zone, where the nurses and staff were supposed to put on bioprotective gear before they entered. Mayinga was cared for by a South African doctor named Margareta Isaacson, who at first wore a military gas mask, but it became increasingly uncomfortable in the tropical heat. She thought to herself, "I can't bear it. I'll be surprised if I come out of this alive anyway." That made her think about her own children. She thought, "My children are grown up. They are no great responsibility." And she removed her mask and treated the dying girl face to face. Dr. Isaacson did everything she could to save Mayinga, but she was as helpless before the agent as medieval doctors had been in the face of the Black Plague. "This was not like AIDS," she would later recall. "AIDS is child's play compared with this." She gave Nurse Mayinga ice cubes to suck on, which helped to ease the pain in her throat, and she gave her Valium to try to stave off her apprehension of what lay ahead. "I know I am dying," Mayinga said to her. "That's nonsense. You are not going to die," Dr. Isaacson replied. When Mayinga's bleeding began, it came from her mouth and nose. It never came in a rush, but the blood dripped and ran and wouldn't stop and wouldn't clot. It was a hemorrhagic nosebleed, the kind that does not stop until the heart stops beating. Eventually, Dr. Isaacson gave her 3 transfusions of whole blood to replace what she lost in nosebleeds. Mayinga remained conscious and despondent until the end. In the final stage, her heart developed a galloping beat. Ebola had entered her heart. Mayinga could feel her heart going blubbery inside her chest, and it frightened her unspeakably. That night, she died of a heart attack. Her room was contaminated with blood, and there was also the question of the 2 nuns' rooms, both of which were still locked and bloodstained. Dr. Isaacson said to the staff, "I won't be of much use to you now," and she got a bucket and mop and washed the rooms. Medical teams fanned out into Kinshasa and managed to locate 37 people who had had face-to-face contact with Mayinga during the time when she had wandered around the city. They set up 2 biocontainment pavilions at the hospital and shut the people up for a couple of weeks. They wrapped the cadavers of the nuns and Nurse Mayinga in sheets soaked in chemicals,
then double-bagged the mummies in plastic and put each one in an airtight coffin with a screw-down lid and held the funeral services at the hospital under the watch of doctors. Carl Johnson, having heard nothing from the team of doctors upriver in Bumba, wondered if they were dead and assumed that the virus was about to go on a burn through the city. He organized a floating hospital ship and had it moored in the Congo River. It was an isolation ship for doctors. The city would be the hot zone, and the floating ship would be the gray area, the place of refuge for the doctors. Approximately 1,000 Americans were living in Zaire at the time. In the United States, the Army's 82nd Airborne Division went on alert and prepared to evacuate the Americans by air as soon as the first Ebola cases started popping up in the city. But to the strange and wonderful relief of Zaire and the world, the virus never went on a burn through the city. It subsided on the headwaters of the Ebola River and went back to its hiding place in the forest. The Ebola agent seemed not to be contagious in face-to-face contacts. It didn't seem to be able to travel through the air. No one caught the virus from Nurse Mayinga, even though she'd been in close contact with at least 37 people. She had shared a bottle of soda pop with someone, and not even that person became ill. The crisis passed. Cardinal. 1987, September. As with Ebola, the secret hiding place of the Marburg agent was unknown. After erupting in Charles Monet and Dr. Shem Musoke, Marburg dropped out of sight, and no one could say where it had gone. It seemed to vanish off the face of the earth. But viruses never go away, they only hide. And Marburg continued to cycle in some reservoir of animals or insects in Africa. On the second day of September, 1987, around supper time, Eugene Johnson, the civilian biohazard expert attached to USAMRID, stood in a passenger arrival area outside the customs gates at Dulles International Airport near Washington. He was waiting for a KLM flight from Amsterdam, which carried a passenger who had come from Kenya. A man with a duffel bag passed through customs, and he and Johnson nodded to each other. "I'm going to leave this person's name out of it. Let's just say he was someone I knew, someone I trust," Johnson explained to me. The man laid down the duffel bag at Johnson's feet, unzipped it, and pulled out a wad of bath towels wrapped around something. Pulling off the towels, he revealed an unmarked cardboard box wound with tape. He handed the box to Johnson. They had little to say to each other. Johnson carried the box out of the terminal building, put it in the trunk of his car, and drove to the institute. The box held blood serum from a 10-year-old Danish boy who will be called Peter Cardinal. He had died a day or so earlier at Nairobi Hospital with a combination of extreme symptoms that suggested an unidentified level 4 virus. As he drove to the institute, Johnson wondered just what he was going to do with the box. He was inclined to sterilize its contents in an oven and then incinerate it. Just cook it and burn it and forget it. Most of the samples that came into the institute, and samples of blood and tissue arrived constantly from all parts of the world, contained nothing unusual, no interesting viruses. In other words, most of the samples were false alarms. Johnson wasn't sure he wanted to take the time to analyze this boy's blood serum if, in all probability, nothing would be found in it. By the time he pulled into the gates of Fort Detrick, he had decided to go ahead. He knew the work would keep him up most of the night, but it had to be done immediately, before the blood serum deteriorated. Johnson put on a surgical scrub suit and rubber gloves and carried the box into the level 3 staging area of the Ebola suite, where he opened the box, revealing a mass of foam peanuts. Out of the peanuts, he fished a metal cylinder sealed with tape and marked with a biohazard symbol. Along the wall of the staging area was a row of stainless steel cabinets with rubber gloves protruding into them.
They were biosafety level 4 cabinets. They could be sealed off from the outside world while you handled a hot agent inside them with the rubber gloves. These cabinets were similar in design to the safety cabinets that are used for handling nuclear bomb parts. Here, the cabinets were designed to keep human beings from coming into direct contact with nature. Johnson unscrewed some wing nuts and opened a door in the cabinets and placed the metal cylinder inside. He closed and tightened the door. Next, he put his hands into the gloves, picked up the cylinder, and looking through a window to see what he was doing, peeled the tape off the cylinder. The tape stuck to his rubber gloves, and he couldn't get it off. Damn, he swore to himself. It was now 8 o'clock at night, and he would never get home. Finally, he got the cylinder open. Inside it was a wad of paper towels soaked in bleach. He pulled apart the wad and found a Ziploc bag. It contained a couple of plastic tubes with screw tops. He unscrewed them and shook out 2 very small plastic vials containing golden liquid. Peter Cardinal's blood serum. The boy's mother and father worked for a Danish relief organization in Kenya and lived in a house in the town of Kisumu on Lake Victoria. Peter had been a student at a boarding school in Denmark. That August, a few weeks before he died, he'd gone to Africa to visit his parents and his older sister. She was a student at a private school in Nairobi. She and Peter were very close, and while Peter was visiting his family in Kenya, the two young people spent most of their time together, brother and sister, best friends. The Cardinal family went on vacation after Peter's arrival and traveled by car through Kenya. His mother and father wanted to show him the beauty and sweetness of Africa. They were visiting Mombasa, staying in a hotel by the sea, when Peter developed red eyes. His parents took him to the hospital, where the doctors examined him and concluded that he'd come down with malaria. His mother didn't believe it was malaria. She began to perceive that her son was dying, and she became frantic. She insisted that he be taken to Nairobi for treatment. The flying doctors, an air ambulance service, picked him up, and he was rushed to Nairobi Hospital, where he came under the care of Dr. David Silverstein, who had also taken care of Dr. Musoke after Charles Monet had spewed the black vomit into Musoke's eyes. Peter Cardinal was a blonde-haired, blue-eyed guy, a tall, thin guy, a fit-looking 10-year-old. Dr. Silverstein recalled as we drank coffee and tea at a table in the shopping mall near his house outside Washington. A small girl sitting nearby burst into wails, and her mother hushed her. Crowds of shoppers passed by our table. I kept my eyes on Dr. Silverstein's face, steel-rimmed glasses, mustache, eyes that gazed into space, as he recalled the unusual death he had seen, which he spoke of in a matter-of-fact way. When Peter came to me, he was febrile, but he was very with it, very alert, and communicative. We gave him an X-ray. His lungs were fluffy. A kind of watery mucus had begun to collect in the boy's lungs, which caused him difficulty in breathing. It was a typical ARDS picture, acute respiratory distress syndrome, like early pneumonia, Dr. Silverstein said. Shortly afterward, he started turning bluish on me. He had blue in his fingertips. Also, he had little red spots. I had everybody glove up before they handled him. We suspected he had Marburg, but we didn't have the paranoia we had had with Dr. Musoke. We just took precautions. In 24 hours, he was on a respirator. We noted that he bled easily from puncture sites, and he had deranged liver functions. The small red spots became large, spontaneous bruises. He turned black and blue. Then his pupils dilated up on us. That was a sign of brain death. He was bleeding around the brain. He swelled up, and his skin filled with pockets of blood. In some places, the skin almost separated from the underlying tissue. This happened during the last phase, while he was on the respirator. It's called third spacing. If you bleed into the first space, you bleed into your lungs. If you bleed into the second space, you bleed into your stomach and intestines. If you bleed into the third space, you bleed into the space between the skin and the flesh. The skin puffs up and separates from the flesh like a bag. Peter Cardinal had bled out under his skin. The more one contemplates the hot viruses, the less they look like parasites, and the more they begin to look like predators. It's a characteristic of a predator to become invisible to its prey during the quiet and sometimes lengthy stalk that precedes an explosive attack. The savanna grass ripples on the plains, and the only sound in the air is the sound of African doves calling from acacia trees, a pulse that goes on through the heat of the day and never slows and never ends. In the distance, in the flickering heat, in the immense distance, a herd of zebras graze. Suddenly from the grass comes a streak of movement, and a lion is among them and hangs on a zebra's throat. The zebra gives out a barking cry, choked off, and the two interlocked beings, the predator and the prey, spin around in a dance until you lose sight of the action in a billow of dust, and the next day the bones have a surface of flies. Some of the predators that feed on humans have lived on the earth for a long time, far longer than the human race, and their origins go back, it seems, almost to the formation of the planet. When a human being is fed upon and consumed by one of them, especially in Africa, the event is telescoped against horizons of space and time and takes on a feeling of immense antiquity. Peter Cardinal's parents and sister were stunned as they watched him being slowly torn apart by an invisible predator. They couldn't comprehend his suffering or reach him to give him comfort. As the blood poured into his third space, his eyes remained open and dilated, staring, bloody, deep, dark, and bottomless. They didn't know if he could see them, and they couldn't tell what he saw or thought or felt behind the open eyes. The machines hooked up to his scalp were showing flat lines in his brain. There was very little electrical activity in his brain, but now and then the flat lines gave a spooky twitch, as if something continued to struggle inside the boy, some destroyed fragment of his soul. They had to make a decision about whether to turn off the respirator. Dr. Silverstein said to them, "We're much better off not letting him survive because of brain death." "If they had only brought him in sooner from Mombasa," the mother said. "I'm sorry, but that would not have helped. There was nothing that anyone could have done," Silverstein replied to her. "He was doomed from the beginning." Working with his hands in the rubber gloves protruding into the cabinets, Gene Johnson took a little bit of the boy's blood serum and dropped it into flasks that contained living cells from a monkey. If anything lived in Peter Cardinal's blood, it might begin to replicate in the monkey cells. Then Johnson went home to get some sleep. The procedure had taken him until 3 o'clock in the morning to finish. In the following days, Johnson watched the flasks to see if there were any changes in the monkey cells. He saw that they were bursting and dying. They were infected with something. The cardinal strain was definitely a hot agent. It killed the cells in vast numbers, and it killed them fast. Now for the next stage of the virus isolation. He drew off a little bit of fluid from the flasks and injected it into 3 rhesus monkeys to infect them with the cardinal agent. 2 of the monkeys died, and the 3rd animal went into borderline shock, but somehow pulled through and survived. So the cardinal agent was viciously hot, a fast replicator, and it could kill monkeys. "I knew goddamned well we had Marburg," Johnson would later say to me. He took some of the cardinal strain and injected it into guinea pigs to see if it would infect them. It killed them like flies. Not only that, the testicles of the males swelled up to the size of golf balls and turned purple. The cardinal strain was a sophisticated organism that knew what it wanted. It could multiply in many different kinds of meat. It was an invasive life form, devastating and promiscuous. It showed a kind of obscenity you see only in nature, an obscenity so extreme that it dissolves imperceptibly into beauty. It made a living somewhere in Africa. What made it particularly interesting was that it multiplied easily in various species, in monkeys, humans, guinea pigs. It was extremely lethal in these species, which meant that its original host was probably not monkeys, humans, or guinea pigs, but some other animal or insect that it did not kill. A virus does not generally kill its natural host. The Marburg virus was a traveler. It could jump species. It could break through the lines that separate one species from another, and when it jumped into another species, it could devastate the species. It did not know boundaries. It did not know what humans are. Or perhaps you could say that it knew only too well what humans are. It knew that humans are meat. As soon as he isolated the cardinal strain and confirmed that it was Marburg, Johnson turned his attention to the question of where and how Peter Cardinal might have become infected. Where had that kid been? What had he been doing to get himself infected? Exactly where had he traveled? These questions haunted Johnson. He'd been trying to find the secret reservoirs of the thread viruses for years. He telephoned a friend and colleague in Kenya named Dr. Peter Tukey, who was a scientist at the Kenya Medical Research Institute in Nairobi. "We know this is Marburg," Jean said to him. "Can you get a history of the kid? Find out where he was and what he did?" Dr. Tukey said he would locate the parents and interview them. A week later, Jean's telephone rang. It was Dr. Tukey on the line. "You know where that kid was?" he said. "He was in Kitum Cave on Mount Elgon." Jean felt a prickling sensation on his scalp. The paths of Charles Monet and Peter Cardinal had crossed at only one place on earth, and that was inside Kitum Cave. What had they done in the cave? What had they found in there? What had they touched? What had they breathed? What lived in Kitum Cave? Going Deep. Eugene Johnson sat at a picnic table at Fort Detrick, near a duck pond, leaning forward and gazing at me. It was a hot day in the middle of summer. He was wearing sunglasses. He placed his large elbows on the table, took off his sunglasses, and rubbed his eyes. He was 6'2", maybe 250 pounds. His eyes were brown and set deep in his bearded face, and there were dark circles under the lower lids. He looked tired. So Peter Tukey got on the phone to tell me that the boy had visited Kitum Cave, Johnson said. I still get chills when I think about it. A few weeks later, I flew to Nairobi, and I talked with David Silverstein, the kid's doctor. Peter Tukey was with me. Then we went every place in Kenya the kid went, even to his house. His parents had a nice house in Kisumu, near Lake Victoria. It was a stucco house with a wall around it, and there was a cook and groundskeepers and a driver. The house was clean and neat, open and whitewashed. We saw that there was a rock hyrax living on the roof. It was a pet, and it lived in the gutters. There were a couple of storks, and there were rabbits and goats and all kinds of birds. I didn't see any bats around the house. He paused, thinking. No one else was around. A few ducks swam in the pond. I was really nervous about talking with the parents, he said. See, I'm a field person. My wife and I don't have children. I'm not the kind of guy who can console a mother. Plus, I work for the U.S. military. I had no idea how to talk to them. I tried to put myself in their place, and I remembered how I felt when my father died. I let them talk about their son. Peter Cardinal and his sister had been inseparable from the moment he arrived in Kenya. The kids had spent the whole time together, doing everything together. So what was the difference in behavior? Why did Peter Cardinal get the virus but not his sister? There was one difference in their behavior. The parents told me a story about the rocks in the cave. They told me their kid was an amateur geologist. There was this issue. Did he cut his hand on any crystals in the cave? We went over that possibility with the parents. Peter had said to them that he wanted to collect some of the crystals in Katoom Cave. So he beat on the walls of the cave with a hammer and collected some rocks with crystals in them. The rocks were broken up by the driver and washed by the cook. We tested their blood, and they were not positive for Marburg. It seemed possible that the point of contact had been the boy's hands, that the virus had entered Cardinal's bloodstream through a tiny cut. Possibly, he had pricked his finger on a crystal that had been contaminated with urine from some animal or the remains of a crushed insect. But even if he had pricked his finger on a crystal, that didn't tell where the virus lived in nature. It didn't identify the virus's natural host. "We went to look at the cave," he said. "We had to protect ourselves when we went inside. We knew that Marburg is transmitted by the aerosol route." In 1986, the year before Peter Cardinal died, Gene Johnson had done an experiment that showed that Marburg and Ebola can indeed travel through the air. He infected monkeys with Marburg and Ebola by letting them breathe it into their lungs, and he discovered that a very small dose of airborne Marburg or Ebola could start an explosive infection in a monkey. Therefore, Johnson wanted the members of the expedition to wear breathing apparatus inside the cave. "I brought with me these military gas masks with filters. We needed some kind of covering to put over our heads, too, or we'd get bat shit in our hair. We bought pillowcases at a local store. They were white with big flowers. So the first time we went into the cave, it was a bunch of Kenyans and me wearing these military gas masks and these flowered pillowcases on our heads, and the Kenyans are just cracking up." They explored the cave and made a map of it. After this scouting trip, Gene Johnson persuaded the Army to sponsor a major expedition to Katoom Cave. Half a year after Peter Cardinal died in the spring of 1988, Gene showed up in Nairobi with 20 shipping crates full of biohazard gear and scientific equipment. It included several military body bags for holding human cadavers. And the members of his team had a serious discussion among themselves about how to handle their own remains if one of them died of Marburg. This time, Gene felt that he was closing in on the virus. He knew it would be hard to find even if it lived inside Katoom Cave, but he felt he was getting too close to fail in his quest. The monster lived in a cave, and he was going in there to find it. The Kenyan government agreed to close Katoom Cave to tourists while the joint Kenya-U.S. expedition searched it for viruses. The head of the expedition was Dr. Peter Tukey of the Kenya Medical Research Institute. Gene Johnson conceived the idea and gathered the equipment and found the money to pay for it. There were 35 team members, and most of them were Kenyans, including wildlife naturalists, scientists, doctors, and laborers. They brought along a large number of guinea pigs, traveling in boxes, and 17 monkeys in cages, including baboons, Sykes monkeys, and African green monkeys. The monkeys and guinea pigs were sentinel animals, like canaries in a coal mine.
They would be placed in cages inside and near Katoom Cave in the hope that some of them would break with Marburg virus. There are no instruments.